This is Morning Edition on KCU. I'm Allie Jones. KCU continues conversations with candidates on the ballot in the big country today with Jody Arrington. The Republican is running for his third term in the U.S. House of Representatives for Texas's 19th congressional district. He has been an avid supporter of President Trump's policies since his first term in 2017. Arrington fended off a primary challenger by Vance Boyd earlier this year, winning nearly 90% of the vote. We heard from the Democratic challenger, Abilene attorney Tom Watson, yesterday. Jody Arrington joins me by Zoom. Let's jump into the first question. How would you rate President Trump and Congress's handling of the COVID-19 pandemic?
Well, I'd say, given the many unknowns, I'd give him a high grade, because while the Democrats were criticizing him as a xenophobic leader, with the restrictions he placed on travel from China and then Europe. But he pressed on. He did it because he knew it was the right thing, even though he would be criticized and that it would be politicized by the Democrat leadership, which it was. I think it, between that and working to partner with the private sector to accelerate the production of critical supplies, I mean, the stockpile was empty of critical supplies for our safety in a situation like this. So in order to replenish those, we had to partner with the private sector. We could not wait on the bureaucracy at CDC or NIH or any of the government agencies. We'd have never gotten there. So I thought that pivoting there and doing the things that we needed to do, also making the investment in developing therapeutics and a vaccine, that was happening early on, and Congress has worked in partnership with the president to provide the funds to, again, expedite that development process so that we can get a vaccine and get treatments to people so that we can give people greater confidence to go out into the marketplace and to get back to work and go back to school. So look, we've never had a pandemic like this. This was the bungling and cover up of China. And instead of, I think the American people are tired of everybody blaming everyone else and instead working together to provide the necessary temporary and targeted relief like we did to 50 million jobs through the Paycheck Protection Program or the employee retention tax credit that gave a tax break to employers to retain their employees, keep them on the payroll and off of unemployment, or the cash assistance, the direct payments to folks to give them individuals and families a little breathing room. So we've done some good things together. Unfortunately, for the last several months, providing any sort of pandemic relief, COVID relief, has been completely politicized. At least in the House, Speaker Pelosi has passed nothing but straight partisan bills that are really going nowhere, and much of it is not even germane, which is to me a shameful thing. I mean, funding for the arts and humanities, marijuana banking, cash assistance to folks who are here illegally, bailouts for union pensions. I mean, this has nothing to do with the folks who are suffering and struggling to survive post-COVID. And it's unfortunate, but I think the president has made a last-ditch effort with his $1.8 trillion counteroffer. We'll see what happens.
What do you see Congress's role is in addressing COVID-19 at this point? Do you see any areas that you'd like to see Congress get more involved in that they haven't already?
Well, I think one of the worst things that came out of the legislation, the CARES Act, to provide relief, and I think the intentions were good, but we ended up paying people more on unemployment through unemployment insurance enhancements than they were making in their previous jobs. So we created a tremendous disincentive for people to go back to work. And talking to companies of different in different industries and sectors of our economy, that has been a real challenge in their recovery efforts. I think that there are some individuals and families who actually work in industries that have a longer tail to recover, and we should be providing them, again, another round of temporary and targeted assistance. I think the Provider Relief Fund was excellent, and I hear from doctors, nurses, and other frontline healthcare workers saying that they had the resources they needed, and it was pretty awesome to watch them on the front lines of this battle. I think there is a major wave of litigation coming in every facet of our economy, and we're going to need to provide COVID-related litigation protection. And without that, I think you're going to see the next big crisis occur, because you're going to have a swarm of plaintiffs' attorneys all over the country suing people and companies who were doing the best they could with what information they had. You know, we were all just doing the best we could. The last thing I'd say is we need policies in place that accompany any funding that encourage reopening our economy and our communities. These shutdown orders have done more damage and will do more damage to public health, to our economy, long term, than the damage done by COVID in the near term. So what we need to do is incentivize and reward those schools that are opening, those communities that are opening, and we can't provide a bailout for everyone, or you'll have states and local governments in a complete shutdown mode for the remainder of the year, and that's unacceptable.
So how do you feel about another stimulus, and should there be a standalone bill, or do you think that all of the funding proposals should be considered together?
Well, I don't have a lot of hope after seeing the last two straight partisan, like no Republicans supported Pelosi's almost $4 trillion bailout bill. Then she took another run at it and passed out of the House a bill with no Republicans and actually lost 17 Democrats. So when she tries to cobble a bill together that's comprehensive, she includes things in there that are untenable. They're poison pills, and they'll never go anywhere. So I think standalone bills for example, we have $130 billion in paycheck protection monies that were left over from the last COVID relief legislation. That program has been extremely successful, but there are some small businesses who need to keep the lights on and people on the payroll, and they need another round of assistance. And we can't do that without legislation. So whether it's paycheck protection or it's direct assistance to the narrow group of folks that are still struggling, or it's some assistance to the airline industry where we're talking about thousands of layoffs, I think that those are appropriate where we have some bipartisan agreement from the outset, and I would support that. Now, I would tell you this, we have hundreds of billions of dollars still working its way through the system. I bet at this point, half of the money is still yet unspent by the states and cities. I know more than half of the monies that were given to support schools have not been spent. So we have to be fiscally responsible, because we've just accelerated our debt, our national debt, to the highest levels they've ever been. And the younger generations of Americans will be paying for this. So it's not like there's not a cost or consequence to spending this money. We need to spend the money where it makes sense, where it's needed, and we need to not just throw money at it to make folks feel better. That's not good governing, and that's why we need to be very targeted in the assistance we provide going forward. And we need to make sure that the policies we have in place prevent frivolous lawsuits, you know, remove the barriers like we did on enhancing unemployment to keep people off payroll, and reward those communities and those schools that are leaning into the recovery and managing the risks and staying open.
You've expressed your support in overturning Obamacare. What has the president and Congress accomplished in the last 4 years to provide an alternative?
Well, my first term in the House, we passed the American Healthcare Reform Act, and it died in the Senate on account of one vote. And it would have fundamentally changed government-controlled healthcare, which is what Obamacare is. And by the way, since the, quote, Affordable Care Act was passed, premiums and deductibles have doubled. You know, people were promised they could keep their plans, they could keep their doctors. None of that was true. So we were sold a bill of goods. It turned out to be a complete disaster. And I think what we need to do is, government has a role in the safety net for seniors and for low-income families and individuals. But the vast majority of Americans need more choices, not fewer choices, for their health care. They need health care providers competing for their business. They need greater price transparency. They need to know which doctors are the best and what their value proposition is. We need more state flexibility. We just need more market-based, patient-centered solutions and not more top-down, government-controlled healthcare. The Democrats are doubling down on this model by basically taking the private healthcare away from 170 million Americans and rolling up healthcare into Washington in a single payer system. It will be completely run by the government, which I think is a major mistake if you want to have quality care and if you want to enhance access to care. Sure, more people got an insurance card because of the Affordable Care Act, but that insurance card was worth nothing to people who couldn't afford the premiums and deductibles on that new Obamacare insurance. There were millions of people, Allie, that paid the fine rather than sign up for Obamacare. That's why we repealed the individual mandate, to give people a choice whether they could find a better healthcare plan for their families outside of Obamacare, or if they could find a better plan in Obamacare, but the government wasn't going to force them to do to sign up for a plan that they couldn't afford or didn't need. So I think that the Republicans have offered solutions. The House passed it, the Senate didn't, and now Democrats are doubling down on government-controlled health care through this Medicare for All, which is socialized medicine.
So we've covered legislation that you proposed to increase penalties for the protesters who are destroying property or who turn violent in our other interviews. But I'm wondering where you stand on the calls to reform training for police officers or the restrictions on certain types of holds or restraints.
Sure. Good question. Policing fundamentally is a local and state issue. One of the problems, Allie, with what's going on in the country and with my colleagues on the Democrat side is their knee-jerk reaction to every problem in this country is more federal government. And in this case, they want to just federalize policing, which I think is a big mistake, just like they want to federalize healthcare, federalize election laws. That's not how this Democratic Republic was set up. It was a narrow role for the federal government. And if it wasn't enumerated in the Constitution, then as the Constitution's 10th Amendment said, it was delegated to the states and the people. Now, the first problem with what happened to George Floyd in Minneapolis is that there's a broken and corrupt set of leaders or leadership in that city. If you have a problem with your police department, then you've got a problem with your city council, with your police commissioner or chief of police, with your mayor. So instead of pointing to Washington, how about we try to uncover the corruption and the incompetence that's happening at the local level that would allow something like that to happen? Now, if it's just an isolated incident, will the law take care to bring to justice those folks involved in the George Floyd incident? I think the answer is going to be yes. Then the question is there a culture of corruption there? Is there a culture of bias or prejudice there, or incompetence, lack of training. I don't think we need to leap to Washington one size fits all solutions. Now, what can the federal government do, and what should it do with respect to making sure that we have the highest standards for law enforcement throughout the country? I think a proper role is for the federal government not to dictate the strategies or the training or the equipment that police officers need to do their job to keep us safe as they risk their lives every day. I think what we need to do is have a database. It's been talked about. I think there's a Republican and Democrat support for this, but we need a database that keeps a list of the bad actors, the police that have been basically recycled through the system, who have committed violations of policy or ethics or the law, and they've abused their authority and their power. We cannot let them just, you know, have a revolving door for them to leave one department or agency only to join another in another state. That's an interstate commerce issue. That's a perfect role for the federal government to play. And I support that. But I don't support the federal government coming up with ways to further hamstring police who are doing a very dangerous job on behalf of our citizens. Look, probably 1% of police officers are corrupt. They're bad. They should be held accountable. But what we're doing is penalizing all the good guys who are honorable, who are brave, and who stand between us and the bad guys every day. And by the way, the Democrat movement to defund the police and to dismantle the police and to further tie their hands is a very dangerous proposition for our men and women in blue. And the people who get hurt by that the most, Allie, are the low-income individuals living in impoverished neighborhoods where the crime is high. Those are the folks that need police as much as any one of our fellow Americans.
Outside of the topics that we've covered, what is your top priority as you look at the next 2 years?
Well, I think what we've been able to do to provide tax cuts, regulatory relief, free and fair trade deals has created record jobs for this country, record low unemployment, record increase in salaries, and median family income has increased at the highest rate in the history of recorded numbers. So what we've seen is an economic renaissance, the likes of which has not been experienced by this country in a half a century, if not more. So I'd like to open up new markets and provide an opportunity for consumers in countries around the world, like we did with NAFTA, which is now USMCA, like we did in Japan, and like we did with China. I think opening up new markets for manufacturers, for farmers, for energy producers, and for our workers will expand opportunities here in this country and strengthen our economy. I think the fact that the military was decimated with cuts during the Obama years and demoralized by the policies of appeasement in the Middle East and beyond from the Obama administration. We're seeing not only rebuilding of the military, but we're seeing morale come back. And we're watching as ISIS was annihilated and Syria was held accountable. And we're not going along with the games of Iran. And now our enemies respect us again. And our allies know we're going to be there for them. We need to do more, make more investment there, because China is making a greater gains than we are. Their military is bigger than ours, and they are the biggest existential threat. I think another piece of this that was unearthed during this post-COVID era was our dependence on China for things that are important to our national security and our citizen safety, like manufacturing antibiotics and other drugs. We need to restructure our supply chain so that we're not dependent on China or any country for things that are critical for public safety and national security. I'd say last thing to mention, just a few here, is we've got to rein in the expansion of the federal government and the spending, and we have got to reduce our national debt, or we will see and experience in the future, in the near term, a sovereign debt crisis that we can't bail out of like we're doing here with this unprecedented pandemic. We have to bring down our debt as a percentage of GDP. We have to reduce our deficit spending, which is now at an all-time high of $1 trillion a year and has been exacerbated significantly because of COVID. That will be the millstone around the necks of our children and grandchildren if we don't do something about it and give them a fighting chance and put them on better financial footing. Right now, that is a dangerous position for the federal government to be in. And I think it's an immoral act by this generation of leaders to not do something about it so that they so that the next generation of Americans are in good stead, not in such a debt hole they could never climb out of, and they suffer the consequences on account of our inability to govern responsibly.
So last question, why should voters in the big country send you back to Washington for a third term?
I think very simply because I've done what I said I would do. I've delivered results for the big country, for the good people of West Texas, whether it was a farm bill that fixed and restored cotton to the safety net, which is billions of dollars to our district and to this region, or securing the B-21 bomber to Dyess Air Force Base. The next generation bomber now will fly out of Dyess and the big country for the next, for the remaining part of the 21st century, which is, by the way, $1 million a day to the local economy. I think they ought to send me back because I've been fighting for their freedom and for their values and for our American way of life. And whether that showed up in delivering services and promises that we made to our veterans and passing legislation in a bipartisan way to help our veterans after their sacrifice, or whether it's strengthening our military, securing the border, or creating more prosperity and opportunity. What I said I would do, I did, and the country is safer, stronger, and more prosperous as a result. And I think that is my job. I think we've just begun. The best is yet to come. And now we're in a leadership position on Ways and Means, the most powerful committee in Congress. I'm chairing the Rural Healthcare Task Force, which is a big challenge for districts and regions like ours. And I'm doing that as an appointee of a Democrat chairman of the Ways and Means Committee and alongside my Democrat colleague, Terry Sewell from Alabama. So I've demonstrated that I'm willing to work with anybody to solve problems and move our country forward. But I've also demonstrated that I will fight for our freedom, and I will fight for the values of West Texans, and I will fight to restore that freedom and return power back to we the people so that our children don't grow up in a fundamentally different country where it's not we the people, it's we the government, because we've created the same failed state of socialism and socialist ideology that has destroyed Venezuela, that has stolen the freedom from Cubans, and that has left hundreds of countries in history on the ash heap of disaster as a result. That's why they should vote for me and send me back to Congress. And I'm looking forward to doing battle for them in the future and for my children and their children.
Thank you again for joining us today, Representative Arrington.
Thank you, Allie. I appreciate the opportunity. God bless and go big country.
Republican Representative Jody Arrington has served the 19th Congressional District in Texas since his first election in 2016. He's running for a third term.
Our coverage of the 2020 election continues tomorrow when we hear from Sam Hatton, the Democrat who's challenging State Representative Stan Lambert for his seat in the Texas State House. I'm Allie Jones, and this is KACU.